Where is pickleball in South Africa as a sport? Is it? I mean, there is an opportunity again in all these countries where and a vast population of and it's accessible and not expensive because you could just literally go and like you can tape up a piece of concrete and play and make up a net, couldn't you?
Yeah, I've been in touch with some of the board members in the South African Pickleball Association. I had lunch with one of the guys.
The SPA? Is that what it is? Or SAPA? Or?
Yeah.
SAPA.
SAPA. Yeah.
Good like an acronym.
It's definitely taking off.
Okay.
Particularly, there's one lady down in the Cape who has done, Kim is her name, she's done some amazing work in the underprivileged areas with kids and in schools. And in fact, she's had pickleball accepted as part of the curriculum in one of the schools.
Right.
And the great thing about that, she explained to me, she said, because pickleball is growing to such an extent, these kids come out of school and they battle to get work, to get jobs. But if we can teach them to become first-level coaches at school, they can go out into the community and they've got a ready-made job as coaches for this growing sport. How clever is that?
Yeah, that just needs foresight, isn't it? It's not looking in the here and now, isn't it? It's looking at the global, the big picture. That's why, so maybe digress slightly. So they're talking about venues, and there's a tenuous link here, but the fact that we need pickleball locations to play pickleball, and I know there are some centres and people are progressing with them and they're combining with paddle, but I was saying, and a lot of people are going, you know, will we get the numbers? And my view is very much build it and they will come, because I believe there is the opportunity for people to play at every single level is just, well, I don't think you can count the numbers, because I think you can start with kids at school. Wonderful to know that it's on someone's radar to have it in a curriculum. You know, imagine having that here in our curriculum, you know. Just picking up a paddle and just giving someone a plastic ball with some holes in it and banging up and down, your dexterity. Not just, for me, I mean, I know, pickleball was a fantastic mental health game for me. You know, wonderful to take you out at the moment, whatever stresses you've got. Children, I'll mention James Townsend, you know, set up a deaf pickleball club. Wonderful. The wheelchair guys.
We have had at Runnymede's some deaf members for quite a while.
Yeah.
About three AGMs ago, during the AGM, we had one of our members actually show us the numbering system. So on Saturday, we have two deaf members playing, two players, and we say the score
with sign.
With sign language.
Which is wonderful. Wheelchair pickleball. And and that's part of the open.
Yeah.
One of our members is adaptive pickleball, you know, for people who are not physically not as able, but, you know, can still play. And you just go that this is an all-inclusive sport.
Absolutely.
And when, you know, we've got gender doubles, we've got mixed doubles, but even now, and also, I mean, one thing I learned very, very early, I never judge a book by its cover because you get whipped by people you think don't look like a sports person, whatever people want to class is what someone should look like. But, you know, you use your brain, you've got your skills, you've got your speed, but it's such an inclusive sport. And
it is. I saw something that every time I tell the story, I get goosebumps again.
Go for it.
I was at the Madrid Open last year, and they had a session in the morning for disabled pickleball players, not wheelchair, not deaf. This was Down syndrome,
right?
Those kind of disabilities.
Yeah.
And to actually say, my arms start to see these poor handicapped people hit a ball, look at it, and it lands in the right place, and the smile and the joy from that measure of success.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know what their life must be like. Luckily, we are, you know, we're all blessed with good health, but the expression on their faces at succeeding,
the joy is
unbelievable to experience.
And that joy, but that joy goes through it all. We are running as a club this year again a Red Nose Day event. Yes. We did it last
year. I've seen it advertised. The world record attempt as well.
We're kind of world record. Yeah. We can't get Guinness on board because they want a lot of money, but, you know, can't quite understand because this is for charity anyway. But we're still going to go for it. And it's trying to get 300 people to play over 12 hours on a continuous different a game of 10-minute games.
Fantastic. Good luck.
Yeah. And hopefully we might achieve it. But it's part of the fun doing it. But we did it. And last year we did something similar. We had a continuous game and people had to predict the scores at the end. So you just every 10 minutes, different people came on, and it was some, I think it was 15,000 points to 14,000, whatever it was. But also, we were running walk-ins, and we had a mixture of people, and we as sort of club members were helping people come on. And my lasting memory of that was there was two elderly individuals, and their mobility was okay, but they were struggling. An old lady, I believe in their 80s. And you put them on the court and we were showing them, like, just doing a little bit of dinking. Within a couple of minutes, she was walloping the ball and you could just see suddenly this competitive urge resonate and coming out of her. And she's going, I can do this. And then looking at her husband, we said, do you think you'd do this again and take it on? And she went, I'm not sure. And of course, I wasn't talking about all these others. I know you're also very active in the U3A, aren't you?
I started the Camberley U3A. It was one of the, I'm pretty sure it was the first in the U3A movement. And again, that was people north of 70, you know, easily in some cases, and all enjoying it and all coming in week after week. And we had a waiting list, and now they've got two groups.
Well, there's a Fleet. I know there's one in Fleet, and I think there's multiple ones. Yeah. You know, I mean, I was thinking of running a U3A tournament, you know, because, you know, just to make, because obviously, you know, you can have tournaments and there's all, and this is a wonderful thing about pickleball, isn't it? It doesn't matter what your age is or what your level is, you can compete. And I think that's what the wonderful thing about, I'm sure Dupre is great, but it maybe there's a bit of adjustment that's needed and some people still criticize it, it's not perfect, but it's a starting point, isn't it? But you can go on a court, I believe in America, what is it, where paddle on a rack. 3.0s, 3.5s, and fairly strict. But you know, as a stranger, you can roll up somewhere, put your paddle there and get a competitive game.
They're always very welcoming. I've played in North Illinois. So I go there for another sporting passion of mine, which is clay pigeon shooting.
Skeets. I was going to ask you, what is skeets? But that's clay pigeon, is it?
That's clay pigeon, yes. I shoot at Bisley. Yeah.
You're a Surrey champion, aren't you?
I am.
I've got a...
And I represented England in 2016, England veterans, very proud of that. And in 1985, I got my Springbok colours. So.
How wonderful. And you've won the Surrey Ski Open Championship 5 times?
I think so. I don't want to say I've lost count, but it must be at least that.
Did you ever get an opportunity maybe to be selected to go to Olympics or something like that?
No. I left it too late. I might have had a chance to try when I was 19, but I lived in South Africa.
Right.
And we didn't have any...
You have Olympics. Guns for a different reason.
No. We weren't allowed in the Olympics. South Africa was banned.
Yeah, apartheid in that period.
Yeah.
So you're growing up then. So we moved away from that. But so you're growing up. So you got into rifle, into clay pigeon growing up or...
Yes, I was 15 when I started. Because my dad had been in clay shooting as well. Right. So that's how I started,
That was an Italian, was that an Italian thing, was it, or just...
Well, it's international.
Yeah. You
know, I mean, there's...
Was dad good? Was dad good at it?
He was very good, yeah.
And you...
Yeah, a lot of British people, I mean, in the Olympics, we have silver and gold medals regularly. Amber Hill, the lady shooter.
And there was a gentleman, I'm not sure if it was Skeets... that we won, it might have been, but he said he goes to the gym and he actually does strength training. He said, I'm not sure if it's clay pigeon, but if it isn't, I'm sorry. But he said, like, he's the only one he knows of himself that actually goes to the gym and does specific strength training for the sport that he does.
Yeah.
And he was so consistent. I think he broke the world record and like only missed two or three. And it's just amazing.
Britain is pretty strong.
So how did you go from skeets to pickleball? Because that's an extremely different...
No. They're totally unrelated. That's just...
How did you find pickleball then?
I think the reason why Karen may have mentioned it or where it stood me in good stead is that I was involved in the administration.
Right.
In fact, even cricket, I spent some time in Namibia and I got involved there. I was vice chairman of the club. And so, you know, I got involved in various sports.
Was that your first intro into sort of administration then through?
Correct, yes. So I've been lucky that I've always been interested in administration by, I mean, I have a finance degree and majored in accounting, so I suppose administration and so on has been part of my life. And I got involved in cricket administration and then shooting administration, and eventually was on the board in San Antonio of the National Skeet Shooting Association of America, which is really the world governing body, for a couple of years. And that stood me in good stead for when I got involved in pickleball, because I knew, you know, I'd had experience with governance, with the democratic
their crossover skills.
And, yeah. And shooting had nothing to do with pickleball except for hand-eye coordination, which in fact cricket as well. I used to regularly field in the slips, first slip, or sometimes play wicket-keeper. So the reflexes and hand-eye coordination of those types of sports is important. But I always played socially table tennis.
Okay.
And that's when I joined the U3A playing table tennis. And in 2016, a gentleman came at table tennis, came to me and said, would you like to try pickleball? And of course, like everybody else, I said, what on earth is that? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
So, no, come, I think you'll enjoy it. So I went and got hooked.
And this was in
2016.
So you're a 9-year veteran.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, who on earth would say that at the age of 65, you can start a new sport? I was 65 then.
Well, do you know, Frank, I have said this. I'm hoping to win a gold medal as a centurion at the Open one day. That is my objective, and I think it might be possible because, I don't know, the Open had 75 plus, didn't it? I think
yes.
it was a what is yes. it? Well, I don't know. Do you know offhand who the oldest player that's competed in the Open?
Not offhand. No. I think there's a couple of over 80s, but I don't. I provide the stats to Karen from the software.
Now, obviously, you played the game of pickleball and you have won medals. I believe you mixed doubles in Amsterdam and the doubles outdoors in Ramsgate in the UK.
Yeah.
And then in the SSIPA in Texas. Now, Ramsgate and Texas, very different. Outdoors in Ramsgate, well, I can't imagine is the same as outdoors in the heat of Texas, or were you very fortunate?
Well, the Texas one, I was there because of my annual skeet pilgrimage. So, skeet.
Yes. Oh, so the SSIPA.
Yeah. I used to go regularly to the World Championships in San Antonio.
Okay, right.
And one of the years that we were there, it happened to coincide with the World SSIPA, Super Senior International Pickleball Association.
I wondered what that acronym stood for. Okay.
And I thought,
Super senior. I like
seeing
it.
I'm a super senior, I'll enter.
Do you know what? You could bring that into the administration, into the Open or something like the super seniors. I think that sounds much better than the over 75s or something like that.
Sure.
It?
Yeah. So
lovely.
Yeah. So we played in Texas, and interesting, we got a massive storm. We played on the Saturday outdoors, massive storm predicted for the Sunday, and they moved everything to the center of Dallas for the Sunday, and we played without any interruption. So that was...
When was this? I don't know if I got...
I think it was before COVID.
Okay.
So it would have been 18 or 17 or 18.
Not long after founding Pickleball England then. Wow. I mean, that's great. And so your major role now, EPF, is the president. You hosted the Europeans here in the UK. So... And how, because the EPF is not that old, is it?
No, it will be two. Our second AGM in May.
So how did this championship come about then? Was that a vision saying, right, we're going to hold a European championship
yes,
one day?
Yes, well, I'm trying to find ways, and there's, again, there's limited things we can do because of the fact that it's volunteers, and some of the board members do as much as they can, but they have full-time jobs. Not everybody is a fanatic like me, finding 26 hours and retired.
You and Karen, I think, are very similar, aren't you, in your efforts?
We are, but, you know, so to the extent that there's availability, you know, on the board, and everyone is willing, but not everybody is able to dedicate the same amount of time. So these initiatives are perforce limited to the amount of time that the volunteers have.
Yeah.
We're trying to establish subcommittees. Language is a little bit of a challenge because, you know, there's three Hungarians willing to help, but, you know, they don't speak English or, you know, it makes life a little bit difficult. But we're trying to find initiatives, projects to unite, to bring the countries together, to grow and support pickleball. So the championships was one obvious. Everybody plays. Everybody likes to compete.
Yeah.
You know, let's see what we can do. And when we started it last year, when we started thinking about it, we were wondering how many countries are going to afford to send 12 people, hotel, travel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we were really, we sort of said, well, maybe we'll get 10. We'll be lucky. And that's why we actually chose the venue, because you have to choose the venue well in advance. And we didn't know. We had no track record.
Right.
So little did we know that we would end up with 24 countries with very strong sponsorship support. Duper were fantastic. Franklin, and we had others as well. But Duper, as the title sponsor, were absolutely fabulous in their support.
Oh, that's good.
And I think from a Duper point of view, you mentioned it a little bit earlier, what people don't quite understand with the rating and ranking and all the maths behind it is that the more numbers are crunched and the more cross-fertilization of players, the more accurate the results come.
Yeah.
If I go and put in one result from one tournament, it's not going to tell me that much. But if I play regularly, particularly if I play in the States or if I play against other Europeans, then the benchmark and the Duper results become progressively more and more reliable.
Well, there's a lot of tournaments in the UK, isn't there? And I know Steve does a lot. And I think we're all sort of saying, Steve, please, can you start? Because you're getting a lot of turnover. And
yes,
it'll help. I think even those people that just come for the recreation,
correct,
it will help them as well. Because, okay, your Duper rating will be what it is. It doesn't mean you have to be competitive. It just means that's what you are. Yeah. You're a 2.5 or a 3.
Yeah.
But it will help the reliability of it all. And
absolutely. And I think we are pushing from an EPF point of view, partly because of the sponsorship, but not just because of that, but also because it makes sense that the more acceptance you have and the more use you make of Duper, the better it becomes for everybody.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And it seems to be the leading contender for international ratings.
And I assume there must be other competitors out there doing something.
UTR is one.
Right.
There's,
it's all about an algorithm, isn't it? It's trying to
algorithm and volume.
Yeah.
Of input.
Yeah, I know. I mean, ours started off. Christo, one of our club members, started off within our club, you know, just to get a baseline for us, and then you start going out and you play in the Open and this. And no, I think it's great because I think that's why, as a player, if you go to someone like that, the paddle in the rack thing, is that if your rating is reliable, then you can just go and walk in anywhere as a stranger, can't you?
Yes.
Which is your hope, your vision for pickleball. I mean, Frank, you've done so much so far. What's driving you? What are you hoping to achieve?
As I said to you, the big challenge right across all our members and then into the international arena is getting the sport recognized, getting the credibility of the sport there. And you can only do that once you are a member of the IOC, once you have proper governance, once control is in the hands of membership. And that takes a while. You know, I mean, that's even bigger than Rome, building it in one day. So there's a bringing together process. There's an education process. we've started one of our board members, Maria Munz, has started a refereeing program, and we saw the first results at the European Championships, and there's more and more students joining, more and more people taking it up, and you know, we want to create our own referees. We want to work in collaboration with USAP,
of course,
but we want to create our own European referees. In the coaching area, there's a lot, although, you know, we don't always want to reinvent the wheel. So we're trying to work with Pickleball England. They are developing some courses.
I know they're trying to adapt the level two course.
School program. I mean, there's so much, but it needs resources.
Yeah.
You know, it needs people to, you know, it's...
Well, if there's anyone watching wants to help, just go on the European Pickleball Federation or Pickleball England and say, look, I'd love to help in some form. And if you've got a few hours a week, it'll make a difference.
Absolutely, because there's nothing more discouraging than sitting on some of the boards and you have people who don't, you know, members of the board who don't have the time and come up with a whole lot of good ideas. Shouldn't we do this? Shouldn't we do that? Yes, we should. Who's gonna take responsibility?
Here's my scroll of ideas that we've all spoken about, but we've only managed to get through 3 or 4 of these 100 because
absolutely.
It's only 26 hours in a day, isn't it?
So that's the challenge, converting. Right. I mean, the sport has grown into a completely different league. It cannot just be run by amateurs.
No.
It can't. So the challenge is, it reminds me of when I started on my own as a one-person business. You know, you post the envelopes, you lick the stamps, you do everything. And then you end up with 2 people, 4, 6, 8. And the dynamics change altogether. But doubling your overheads from 1 to 2 or from 2 to 4.
Doesn't mean doubling. You're increasing the number of
people. You've got to work harder to justify it. So that change...
That step change, isn't it? It's called step change, isn't it?
It's a challenge.
If you go from 1 to 2 million turnover, it's not doubling the turnover. It doesn't mean it's not doubling your workforce. It could be quadrupling it, couldn't it?
And
I mean, is there a day? I mean, you know, the excitement. I mean, like the World Pickleball event in India would look fantastic. The razzmatazz, and there's a lot of money out there. Is there a danger of, you know, like a Kerry Packer situation if we're not careful that the wrong people throw a bit of money at this, and you know, the governance is there at the moment, isn't it? And somehow, if people like yourself aren't still trying to bring people together as opposed to separating people.
Yeah, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is anything that grows pickleball and grows the interest and publicizes pickleball is good.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether it's the wrong people or the right people or the money people. That grows and publicizes the game. But at some point, just like I always quote the example of US baseball.
Yeah.
There's the pro leagues, there's the amateur, there's the Olympic side. Everybody needs to coexist eventually.
Yeah.
So at the moment, it's the gold rush and you know everyone trying to find a space for themselves and entrepreneurs thinking about themselves only.
Yeah.
Without looking at the bigger picture. At some stage, and that's maturity of a developing sport, at some stage it needs to stabilize into coexistence where the pros make money, the players, the entrepreneurs and the professional leagues make their money, and the amateurs are in the Olympics, but we can use the pro players because we want the best in the Olympics. So at the moment, until you get that governance and you try and put all these things in place and convince even the money people, if we're in the Olympics, it'll actually be better for you and for us.
Well, exposure, isn't it?
It helps. So it's a jockeying for stability, for position at the moment.
But the sport's in good hands.
I think so. I mean, ultimately...
Certainly in Europe and in the UK, I believe it's in really great hands.
Yeah.
Do you have much contact with the US, as in with the government side of it, to try and cross the pond and bring the sport together?
Yes, recently we've managed to collaborate very well with USAP on the refereeing, where, again, their structures that they have in place are excellent, and we're happy to sort of become members of the refereeing group.
Do the referees get paid in America?
I think, again, that's growing. I think originally it was some expenses and maybe there's a small per diem, and it is increasing, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing people don't see, isn't it? I mean, you're starting to create an economy.
Yeah.
You know, job opportunities for people, you know, again, at schools, you know, what can you do? Coaching, this and that. There's so much, isn't there?
I
mean, looking at it sort of semi-retired, but doing part-time in the mornings and looking at opportunities within the pickleball world and you know, doing this for fun. And then you should start looking, and there's so much you could be doing to help the game, isn't it? And I mean, venues, I mean, I don't know what your thoughts are on venues, you know, and...
Well, I think it's coming. I think there's one or two entrepreneurs already starting to think of venues. And, you know, obviously in the planning, you've got to figure out capacity and utilization. And, you know, it's no use having dedicated courts and having them 20% occupied. So that's the challenge. But as the numbers increase, so I believe dedicated facilities and leisure centres will favour pickleball more and more, and it will grow. But it's all part of growing pains.
There's a combination I see a lot, though, is coming, is that the centres I've known, heard of, open the small ones. There's a collaboration with Padel from a financial benefit because they charge more. But there's a little conflict there, isn't it, in a way that you've got two sports in a dedicated centre, but one's got a different governing body than another. But I think all of these sports, there's room for everyone to come together and work together. Because I don't know if it's true. Padel was run by the LTA, isn't it? I believe it's governed by the LTA. And I don't know if they're 100% happy of how that's gone.
Yeah, I've heard that Padel are not happy at all.
And it probably makes it even worse that pickleball then got it's got the Sport England and that governance of its own sport. Talking to them and working with them, because again, they're a newish sport in the UK, aren't they? I mean, it's been around a long time, paddle, isn't it, in Europe?
It has. I mean, when you look at current leisure centres, you get a couple of squash courts, you get a couple of badminton courts, so they have coexisted.
Yeah.
So there's no reason why, you know, we shouldn't cater to both. I'm still a little bit sceptical about how long Padel will last. Because to me, having to spend £60,000 to create one court compared to what you spend for it.
See, that number, I've heard 25K, 60K. Oh. But, you know, but even so, it's a lot of money to create one court, isn't it?
Whatever, compared to pickleball.
Yeah.
So that necessitates extra fees to be charged. Well, there'll always be people willing to pay that. But I don't know whether that will limit its growth in any way.
Well, if it's not accessible to people, and you know, I've heard numbers between £40 an hour to £120 an hour, depending on where you go and play. That's not accessible to everyone.
Compared
and
it, that's five.
Exactly, a fiver, or even I've paid £2.35 because when there's more numbers and whatever, but certain places, but the quality's not great.
Yeah.
But there is a level I think people will pay to go and play.
Yes.
So how does that stay? Because then what it does, it becomes an elitist, doesn't it? It becomes those that can afford it will play it.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't mean everyone gets the chance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you won't get the growth of it. You won't get the grassroots coming through. So that's an interesting question.
So I think for an entrepreneur, as long as they get a return on their investment for having one or two paddle courts and 10 pickleball courts, that's fine. It's all about ROI at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, that's true. We're going to wrap up soon, but I just think going back to, your greatest success with the EPF is the Europeans.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my pride and joy.
Is it? And what gives you the pride? What gives you the joy? What was it about it?
Well, so.
The fact that England won, but.
Well, I'm very pleased that England won, obviously, but I did have some split loyalties, I guess, with being Italian.
Well, you're going to Italy next year, so maybe Italy can win in
November. I don't think they're strong enough. There were a few challenges. One was one of differentiation. So, you know, we have the monthly local tournaments that people just arrive and play in.
Yeah.
We have the English Open and the Nationals, which is a different formula. I wanted to try and find something a little bit different for.
Right.
So with the Olympics aspiration, the first thing was the opening ceremony. That was my my conception and my vision, and I wanted emotional music to march into. So we had the Ode to Joy, which is the European, and then we had a couple of others, and for each team to walk in behind their flag, because I've represented South Africa, I've represented England, I know there is no bigger thing in sport, no matter, you know, obviously the pros winning millions at Wimbledon or so, it's money and it's great, but actually standing on a podium and they playing the national anthem for you as a winner, that is just...
I was speaking to Louis, and I think he said the overriding thing, the joy for him was, one, I think he was the flag bearer.
Yeah.
And he also saying, you know, just hearing that, because as a child, any child, whatever sport you grew up with, representing your country, holding the FA Cup up or whatever it is, and representing your country and having that badge and going, and you know, but, for a new sport as well, wonderful.
Yeah, so interesting. That is particularly more so in Europe.
Yeah.
I lived in America for 4 years.
Right.
With their Super Bowls. And World Series and what have you, but it's regional passion. International passion, you know, compared to rugby and cricket, and it's only when the Olympics come round that they have Team USA. The rest is very local. So so that was, and I mean, everybody I speak with sort of says, I've never experienced such emotion at a sporting event. You know, it's the same when you, as a kid and so on. I mean, I remember watching the green cap of Barry Richards and Eddie Barlow walking on a test match against Australia with Bill Laurie's Aussies when before South Africa was banned. You know, the excitement and the thrill you get. And that was the same. Also, the presentation, having the national anthems, and then having so many countries there and different languages, different cultures. It was just incredible. And seeing the level of enjoyment.
And also the pre-tournament event, I mean, which I went to as well. I mean, the fact that, you know, that's what's great about it. It doesn't become exclusive to not just the pros, but everybody can say, I was at the Europeans and it was there. And then by doing that, people might then just grab that and go, oh, I'm going to come at the weekend and watch this. And, you know, and that is what I think is great. And,
but
long live that.
Yeah, going back to inclusivity, not just in the general wider context of the pre-EPC, during the tournament, I picked up a lot of flack, and this year as well, but the board is sticking to its guns. In theory, a team event basically should be head-on full team against the full team. So a mixed pair, a men's doubles, ladies doubles, all playing in a team event, and then you end up with a score.
Yeah.
What we've got is a hybrid.
Right.
Where it was a men's doubles event, it was a mixed doubles event, and a ladies doubles event, which makes it a hybrid to the extent that that's more like normal tournaments. It's not...
But all the scores mattered, though, didn't they?
All the scores mattered, yes. Yeah,
the results all came together, didn't they?
Correct. But it's not an individual head-to-head full team against full team, which is what some countries are pushing for. You know, like some of our regional leagues, club against club, they play three games as part of a contest.
Yes.
Whereas we separated them. The reason for doing that is if you have a team of three... men's doubles, ladies' doubles, and mixed doubles, that means that some of the smaller countries need to have three pretty good sets of players. And what would the result have been? England and Spain probably winning just about everything. Whereas the way we did it...
Was it a team of six?
Correct. That would have been, women, that would have been a team of six had we had it in that format.
Well, what was the team size?
Yes, six and six for veterans, because we had over 50.
So there were six in each, so three men and three women in the current form.
Yes, but the ladies played in the ladies' doubles event.
Yeah.
Okay, what the countries have asked for and what the classic team event is, almost need a whiteboard to...
Yeah, no, I was getting a little lost myself. But. Yeah,
okay, so the current Southeast Leagues, Northwest Leagues in England, you go...
We have a gender doubles, ladies, and then a men's doubles. Then
all playing against each other.
Yeah, in one match.
And you get the score, so one club wins that whole contest.
Yes.
Whereas... In the EPC, we modified that.
Yeah.
That we had ladies' doubles. Yeah. All the ladies played. Okay, we added the scores together at the end, but it wasn't a full complement of.
Was it round robin? Was it?
It was round robin, but the ladies played against the ladies.
Yeah.
The men played against the men as separate. And then we had winners of the men's doubles, winners of the ladies' doubles, which is more a classic. But.
And then you had mixed as well.
But the wonderful thing of that is within the ladies' doubles, Serbia managed to win a bronze medal.
Yeah.
Germany won a medal.
It wasn't the one team. England might have got a bronze in the ladies' doubles, but overall, they won more because I think they got to the semifinals of the mixed doubles and knew that they'd won the whole event, whether they won or not because of the other. And that's great because every match... And everyone supports everyone then, don't they? Yeah, because everyone goes, come on,
absolutely.
That one point or that matters, one win matters.
And but had we had team against team, I think it would have excluded...
And you got resistance to that, did you?
Well, there's some countries prefer the classic team, which I don't disagree with, but that will rule out a whole, you know, all the smaller groups because you have to have six strong players.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you've got two pro ladies, for example, that qualify to play, you can win the ladies.
Yes.
But the ladies, if it gets lost because they got weak men and weak, they cannot win the individual.
No.
So it was a bit of a hybrid, but so it was the inclusivity.
Are you sticking to that format next year?
Yes, for one more year at least.
Okay, good.
And I'll take the flack, but I think it's worth it just to see, you know.
I don't think you'll get any complaints from England.
No, we had a wonderful team.
So really. That was the pride for you was obviously the opening ceremony. You had a closing ceremony?
No, because by that stage everybody's tired, everybody wants to go home. Yeah, and just the organization, the help we got from Picklebee, the volunteers, so many people willing to give their time. That is amazing to see people just coming down, spending the full day there, working, and the organizers of the volunteers as well.
Oh, it's an industry, isn't it? And it's an organization. Frank, I've taken enough of your time. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you ever so much.